Record Request Program, Housewife Choice. This week, don't make fun of the festival.
Welcome again from Maureen Lipman
and Russell Davis
to another jumble sale of items from the post-war years.
When men were men
and women let them get away with it.
And housewives had the choice of records anyway, every weekday morning from 10 past 9 to 5 to 10 in the Light Programme.
We've reached the festival year of 1951, which started well for radio as early as New Year's Day, when a new serial could be heard. It had been announced experimentally the previous May.
A new radio serial, The Archers, starting in the Midland Home Service on Monday, is written by the Dick Barton team, Edward J. Mason and Jeffrey Webb, and dramatizes the day-to-day life of a farming family.
Or, as we came to call it, an everyday story of country folk.
Dan Archer has bought Jack's small holding in Ambridge.
Cecil Wilson reviewed the opening episode in the Daily Mail.
The Archers, rustic rivals to Dick Barton and the Dale family, made their national radio bow yesterday. This saga of the soil opened on a simple domestic note, a New Year's Eve party at the farmhouse, a hint of romance in Philip's life, and his frantic search for the family car to take him to the new job.
There were pictures of June Spencer and Norman Painting, who played Peggy and Phil respectively and still do, and of Harry Oakes, the first Dan Archer. Since Dan has gone through a few permutations since then, you might like to hear his original voice.
Just wait till we start things going in good earnest. Now I've got the blooming place, I don't know how we're going to cope with all the jobs.
What is it I heard? What's up to you, Dan, my old pal?
Well, I was just trying to work out in my own mind how we can keep the small holdings going as well as Brookfield.
Oh, that's all right. If it's all buckled in, we'll get to it.
Aye, but giving Peggy a helping hand one thing, working for Dan Arch is another.
Not to me, my old beauty. That is the same to you as what I did to Peggy.
Harry Oakes as Dan, with Robert Maudsley as the Walter Gabriel of those days. It would be an exaggeration to say that everybody was suddenly talking about farming, but certainly housewives were happy to hear Tennessee Ernie singing about it.
I got the milk them in the morning, feed them. Milk them in the evening blue. This old barnyard heifer got me blue down to my shoes. I get up every morning for anything, sir, that gets back with a tail full of truffle furs. I got to milk them in the morning, feed them. Milk them in the evening blue. I got to milk them in the morning, feed them. Milk them in the evening blue. This old wall-eyed jersey ain't worth the tub to teach you. I work hard all day, I bring it in my crop. Then I have to milk you and you won't give 9 drops. I got to milk them in the morning, feed them. Milk them in the evening blue.
Dog, stand still, you leather-headed old heifer. I'll hang a knot on you with a rail in a minute.
Hard to coming out here every whole morning trying to milk you now. Stand still. Oh, now. I got the milk them in the morning, feed them. Milk them in the evening blue. I don't know why I don't tell you. Just look at the money I lose.
You put your foot in the bucket. Kick over the stew. I swear I'm gonna swap you for a blue nose mule.
I got to milk them in the morning, feed them. Milk them in the evening blue. I got to milk them in the morning, feed them. Milk them in the evening blue.
Now, look at here, old heifer.
I'm really gonna tell you some news.
Even though I said you wouldn't give 9 words. Bless your old heart. I love you so much it hurts. I got the milk come in the morning. Be done. Milk come in the evening blue. Get over now. Milk come in the evening blue.
Tennessee Ernie's Milk'em in the Morning Blues. Actually, 1951 turned out to be the year in which Mr. Morris Webb's Ministry of Food appealed to housewives to order a little less milk.
Relinquish a pint of milk a day, or something like that. Meat was on a tenpenny ration, meanwhile, and in January, housewives learnt that Swedish reindeer meat might soon be in the shops to supplement the stock.
Whereupon the meat ration fell to 8 pence worth. Having eaten stodgy food for so many years, people by 1951 were understandably all kinds of undesirable shapes. The BBC's television service decided to do something about it, and by March it was said that thousands of men and women were writing in every day for the TV diet sheet, or, as one headline put it,
20,000 fat women appeal to BBC.
I'm sure the feeling was mutual. But the medical an editorial in the British medical journal said the
might be described as an illustrated correspondence course. This is, in effect, what the BBC is doing.
It is work, anyway. The featured TV slimmers, Mrs. Glass and Ames, lost more than 2 stone each.
The scriptwriter Ted Kavanagh of Itmar fame had found his own method.
After 3 months of eating only oranges, he has become streamlined. He has lost 4.5 stone.
And it was in this miniaturized condition that he appeared on the first edition of television's What's My Line in July, along with Barbara Kelly.
Housewife's Choice didn't have any records available specifically for slimmers, although Dry Bones and The Song of the Prune continued to do well.
But it was a big year for wishing your friends all the best in a musical way. In fact, I suspect that records like Donald Pierce's I Hope You Have a Happy Birthday were made especially to do well as request items. Spike Jones had a popular record out called Mommy, Won't You Buy Me a Baby Brother, which my mother must have listened to since my baby brother was born in 1952.
But the most popular message song of 1951 was this one by Steve Conway with Phil Green and his orchestra, and of all things, the Hastings Girls Choir.
And bring you safe. back home.
The early months of 1951 were fuller than ever of quaint newspaper stories about the BBC.
After an inquest on his off-the-record comments in Monday's broadcast, the BBC last night decided to
wrest
Mr. Gilbert Harding, for the time being, from the quizmaster's chair in 20 Questions. Earlier, programme chiefs heard a playback of the broadcast in which listeners were puzzled by Mr. Harding's reference to
this nonsense.
They decided the programme was
unsatisfactory
and cancelled 2 repeat broadcasts.
News about people's wages at the BBC kept leaking out.
Radio's top-ranking stars earn between £300 and £400 a week from the BBC. At the other end of the salary scale are the choir boys. They get 5 shillings a broadcast. People interviewed on regular features like In Town Tonight are paid nominal fees ranging from 1 guinea upwards. Radio producers and announcers receive up to about £19 a week.
And the BBC needed up to about 7 of them as main announcers and newsreaders, the Big 7, as they were called. Every so often there was a sort of cabinet reshuffle and the Big 7 had to be reselected. It happened in January 1951.
Mr. Frank Phillips and Mr. Alvar Liddell, last of the wartime newsreaders to remain on the BBC staff, are among the finalists for the Big 7.
And they duly got in, along with Lionel Marston, the future TV newsreader Robert Dougal, Robin Holmes and Colin Doran, still familiar names to listeners, and one perhaps you might not have thought of, Alan Skempton. To me, Frank Phillips still sounds like the voice of authority with a capital A.
On this disc, the text is the same as before, but some of the stresses and phrasings are wrongly made, and the inflections may not always convey the meaning the writer had in mind. Here is the news. The latest British jet fighter flew from London to Paris this afternoon in about 21 and a half minutes. This clipped 6 minutes from the previous unofficial record time. The plane, the Hawker 1052, took off from London Airport just after 2:30, and just before 3 o'clock was over the finishing line at Villacoublay Airport, near Paris, which is 221 miles away.
The sound of a man earning 19 quid a week.
When Sir Thomas Beecham made an arrangement of Balt's The Bohemian Girl for radio in 1951, he was offered just over that, 20 guineas. He wasn't pleased with the BBC.
I therefore take pleasure in informing you that at no time and nowhere in the course of a long career, actually 50 years, have I received such a preposterously inadequate, thoughtlessly impudent, and magnificently inept proposal or offer from anyone.
It would have been interesting to hear Sir Thomas's opinion of the next record, the Housewife's Choice favourite for 1951.
Ooh, once upon a time, there was a quack, 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 quack.
There's a little white duck sitting in the water, a little white duck doing what he oughta. He took a bite of a lily pad, slapped his wings and he said, I'm glad I'm a little white duck sitting in the water. Quack, 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 quack.
Ooh, rack, rock, rack, rack, rock, rack.
There's a little green frog swimming in the water, a little green frog doing what he oughta. He jumped right off of the lily pad that the little duck bit. I'm glad I'm a little green frog swimming in the water. There's a little black bug floating on the water, a little black bug doing what he oughta. He tickled the frog on the lily pad that the little duck bit. I'm glad I'm a little black bug floating on the water. There's a little red snake lying in the water, a little red snake doing what he oughta. He frightened the duck and the frog so bad. I'm glad I'm a little red snake lying in the water.
Can't
have it,
nobody left.
Boo hoo!
In the water.
Nobody left. Doing what he oughta. Nothing left but the lily pad. The duck and the frog ran away. There's nobody left sitting in the water. Boo hoo! He thought of the snake that ate the bug, that tickled the frog, that went to chug. There's nobody left to sing about a rat and a lack. Not even a little white duck.
What?
Danny Kaye's Little White Duck, by some margin the housewife's most played single record of 1951.
Or Festival of Britain year, as everybody remembers it. It was the centenary of the Great Exhibition of 1851, and the Labour government had wanted to do something about it ever since coming to power at the end of the war.
It was the editor of the News Chronicle, Gerald Barry, who first promoted the idea, which did him a bit of good since he was eventually made Director General of it, with Herbert Morrison, known as Lord Festival, taking the cabinet responsibility.
The festival hall was built, and we first began to hear the phrase South Bank. There were pleasure gardens and a fun fair in Battersea Park.
And all kinds of exhibits were grubbed together by, among others, Hugh Weldon, an arts council man at the time. Not all the suggestions made were very inspiring. Michael Frayne, in his chapter on the festival, in the excellent book The Age of Austerity, records that the Ministry of Pensions asked that room should be found for
a modest display of artificial limbs.
There was a netball tournament here, a Morris dance there. The Druids made a special festival excursion to Stonehenge. In fact, everyone celebrated as best they could and made sure to put festival in the title of their revelry.
But it was a London event, really, with the capital's great buildings floodlit, as though to banish the last memories of the blackout.
May the 3rd was festival opening day, and Housewife's Choice celebrated in rare fashion by changing its name to London's Choice.
Today, all eyes and ears are upon London,
warbled the Radio Times.
In this program, Billy Cotton presents records chosen by Londoners.
Billy Cotton, whose band show was beginning to make itself a national institution on Sundays at lunchtime, had already attracted some press attention in February, when
the playing of the comedy song Oh, Oh, What a Referee over loudspeakers on Dorset football grounds was last night banned by the Council of the Dorset FA.
Oh, what a referee!
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We are now taking you over for a commentary on the football match between Billy Cotton's layabout and the Wandsworth Walkout.
Ah, well, folks, here we are. And it's a smashing day here. And there's a smashing crowd. And it looks as if we are going to see a really smashing day. What do you think of the prospect, academically speaking?
Smashing.
What's your referee? What's your referee? And his little wooden whistle, wooden whistle.
Billy Cotton refrained from giving us that one on London's Choice, but he did get in three others of his. Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner, which was fair enough. His own version of Good Luck, Good Health, God Bless You, which was pushing it a bit.
And a song called Stick It on the Wall, Mrs. Riley, which may have been about festival posters, though I doubt it. Festival day is here. Britain goes gay.
Cried the Daily Mail, rather strikingly to the modern eye.
The Mail's radio critic, Colin Knox, had a feeling in his bones.
I know this is a dreadful thing to say, but I have a feeling that the Festival of Britain will be a tearing success. My reason? Because everyone, right, left, and even centre, is making very rude jokes about it.
We're proud to say in every way we're ordinary folk. But please observe, we still preserve our sturdy hearts of oak. Although as servants of the state, we may have been coerced. As we've been told to celebrate, we'll celebrate or burst. Though while we brag, our shoulders sag beneath a heavy yoke. We all get terribly heated if it's treated as a joke. How Don't make fun of the festival. Don't make fun of the fair. We downtrodden Britishness learned to be skittish and given in pledge and the devil may care to the wide, wide world. We'll sing God for Harry. And if it turns out all right, Knight Gerald Barry, clear the national decks, my lad. Every one of us counts. Grab the traveler's checks, my lad, and play that none of them bounce. Take the future and is made. Play for further martial aid. Have the toast from cavalcade, addressfully rewritten. Peace and dignity we may lack, but wave a jolly trade union jack. Hooray for the festival of Britain. We've never been exactly keen on showing off or twank, but as they say, the gay display means money in the bank. We'll make the dreadful welkin ring from Penge to John O'Groat, and cheer and shout and laugh and sing before we cut our throats. We know we're caught, but must support this patriotic clank. And though we'd rather have shot ourselves, we've got ourselves to thank. Oh, don't make fun of the festival. Don't make fun of the fair. We must pull together in spite of the weather that dampens our spirits and strings our hair. Let the people sing, even though they shiver. Roses red and noses mauve. Over the river, though the area fairly small, climb Discovery's dome. Take a snooze in the concert hall. At least it's warmer than home. Blow your trumpets, roll your drums. Cross your fingers, hold your thumbs. Even if nobody comes, don't be conscience smitten. If no other sea trade appears, we'll have to work for a thousand years to pay for the festival of fun of the festival, don't make fun of the fair. We must have a look at the cookery book to prevent us from spreading alarm and despair. We can serve whale steak when the weather's hotter and in place of entrecote. What's wrong with otter? Greet the gala with fervent boys. Learn to dance in the dark. Build the Sunday observance, boys. The shrine and that'll be dark. Prance about in funny hats. Show the foreign diplomats that our proletariat milder than a kitten. We believe in the rights of strike, but no, we bloody well got the light. Our own darling festival, we'll pay for the festival. We'll pay for the festival.
Noel Coward, of course, in a number from the Lyric Review, Don't Make Fun of the Fair.
Advice not taken by the goons who mounted a salute to Britain in their newly networked series, Crazy People.
But the signs were that the festival attractions were working. On May the 15th, the day's visitors to the South Bank numbered 93,012.
There were some extremely newfangled things to see.
Like everyone else, I came to a standstill before the electric brain, or, as they prefer to call it, the Nimrod digital computer. This looks like a tremendous grey refrigerator, and it has more wiring in it than the rest of the exhibition put together, and I'm not surprised. It's absolutely terrifying. What you do, if you have the courage, is to volunteer to play a game against this machine. It's based on the old game where you have four heaps of matches, and each player takes one or more away, but only from one heap, and the person who takes the last match wins. Once you get into a position where you can lose, the machine knows it's in the bag immediately, and a little panel lights up saying smugly, safe. Safe for the machine, that is. You can't win once you've made a wrong move. One of the engineers in charge told me he had three engineering graduates to dinner one night, and he spent half an hour explaining a special way, the only way you can hope to beat the machine, and they couldn't get it. So then he played it with his wife on the back of an envelope, and she won straight away.
It was all very nearly enough to make you forget the realities of 1951, which were that the first 5 months of the year were the wettest since Napoleonic times.
The festival tea was as much as threepence a cup, with the cheapest coffee fourpence, not to mention some impossibly cheesy roasted brew intended for visiting Americans and costing up to ninepence a slurp.
And that the situation in distant Korea would lead, as like as not, to another world war. Housewives probably preferred not to think too much about that, though the thought may have crossed their minds while they listened, as they often did, to Miss Hui Li singing Rose, Rose, I Love You in Chinese.
Bye.
Miss Swae Lee, with a record discovered, as it were, by the occasional housewife choice compere Wilfred Thomas, who wrote English words to it and provided a hit for both Petula Clark and Frankie Lane under the title Make Way. As well as unusual sounds, 1951 was a year of strange shapes.
Like the Skylon, the Festival of Britain sculpture, or vertical object, which appeared to stand on the south bank with no visible means of support. Like the festival itself, some critics said.
Or you could go to the cinema. American films were in plentiful supply all over the world. In Accra, for example, where Punch found this wonderfully unpunctuated advertisement.
Joan Fontaine, Burt Lancaster in Kiss the Blood Off My Hands, the story of a love that had no right to be co-starring Robert Newton.
American records, too. Above all, those of Al Chernick, alias Guy Mitchell, whose hits were specially fashioned to appeal both to marching soldiers in Korea and to their wives at home. He easily outnumbered all the opposition on Housewife Choice in 1951, if you add up the requests for My Heart Cries for You, The Roving Kind, and My Truly, Truly Fair.
Some and sails a brine, but I'm in love with a pretty little maid. For work I have no time. She's my truly, truly fair, truly, truly fair. How I love my truly fair. There's songs to sing her, trinkets to bring her, flowers for her golden hair. Once I sailed from Boston Bay, bound for Singapore. But one day out in a mist or so, swam right back to shore. Back to my truly fair, truly, truly fair. How I love my truly fair. There's songs to sing her, trinkets to bring her, flowers for her golden hair. And she loves me, pardon if I boast. At times we fight all the livelong night about who loves her the most. My truly, truly fair, truly, truly fair. How I love my truly fair. There's songs to sing her, crickets to bring her, flowers for golden hair. Still, I'm gonna try. There's songs to sing her, trinkets to bring her, flowers for golden hair. How I love my truly fair.
Back in January, the new controller of the light program, Kenneth Adam, had sent a stiff memo to the head of gramophones.
You are, I know, preparing a list of Housewives Choice presenters, past, present and future, and you know, I believe, that I do not want any further commitments made until we have had a chance of a talk. I think I ought to tell you that the more I look into it, the more perturbed I am about the program as a whole, and I think the time is overripe for a radical overhaul. When first I am told that dance band leaders appearing on the program pay outside scriptwriters to package their appearances because it is worth their while to do so, and when second I am confronted, too late to do anything about it, with as nauseating a script as that of
Name and Address Supplied
for today, I feel that something must be done and done quickly. Isn't it odd that
the same Mr. Supply
should appear twice in the last 3 months, if, as you suggest, there is such pressure to get into the program? And even granting
the unfortunate Mr. Supply,
is there any justification at all for this revolting type of script with adjurations to the girls and references to their urchin cuts? Further, is there any justification for the inclusion of such a number as Puddy Taps, which is being played by everybody else? Down Your Way has vastly improved its musical content and is doing record business.
That's so to speak.
Is there any reason why Housewives' Choice, put on by the right people and including a more strictly scrutinized selection of records, should not do the same?
The result of this broadside seemed to have been that Lawrence Tibbett got to sing the Largo Al Factotum on the programme quite a lot, but that's about all. Still, a critical eye was now being kept on Housewife's Choice, and by festival time in May, the man keeping it was the well-remembered Franklin Engelman, who had his own style of ticking off.
I didn't see today's script in time, but my copy reads for the first tune...
Mrs. Smith of 22 Roby Street, Bootle, is the housewife whose choice chases the sleep out of our eyes and sets all hands on deck, played by Billy Cotton and his band.
At 9:10, this, even in fun or sarcasm, is likely to enrage the housewives who have been up since 6 a.m. Unawareness of how the rest of the world lives is one of the original sins in radio.
Jezebel, it was you. If ever an angel fell, Jezebel, it was you. Jezebel, it was you. If ever a pair of eyes promised paradise, deceiving me, leaving me, leaving me blue. Jezebel, it was you. If ever the devil's plan was made to torment man, it was you. Jezebel, it was you. 'Twould be better had I never known a lover such as you. Forsaking dreams and all for the siren call of your own. Like a demon, love possessed you, obsessed me constantly. What evil star is mine that my fate designed should be? Jezebel, if ever a pair of eyes promised paradise, deceiving me, deceiving me, leaving me blue, Jezebel, it was you. If ever the devil's plan was made to torment man, it was you. Night and day, every way, Jezebel, Jezebel, Jezebel.
And that was Jezebel by the very popular Frankie Lane and his Echo Chamber.
Drop snugly into place your saucepan's lid and boil your suet roll. So, British housewife, can you help to save 1 million tons of coal? Warmed by the fuel minister's acclaim, you need not pause to think how never buying saucepan lids might save 1 million tons of zinc.
That verse by B.A. Young, published by Punch in 1951, was called Housewife's Choice. The two words just went together naturally by now. Philip Hope Wallace in The Listener felt that all this harping on housewives was suspicious.
Speaking as what I suppose ought to be called a non-housewife, I must say I smell a good deal of appeasement of this species in the wind. housewife this, housewife that. Even if they make up 90% of the listening public, they can hardly want to have themselves so persistently plugged.
Well, I don't know so much. They still have a heck of a lot to complain about, like reduced rations and reduced housekeeping when the rate of income tax went up sixpence in the budget.
Petrol was up fourpence halfpenny a gallon to 3 and sixpence. Purchase tax was doubled on cars, radio, television and domestic appliances, including the iniquitously named mechanical charwoman.
Nothing floors me. I can scrub, dry, polish, vacuum, dust, says the mechanical charwoman. The mechanical charwoman will do the hard work in every room in your home, from £32.10 to £58.
Four militant housewives were desperate enough after the budget to attempt to burn their ration books outside the House of Commons. The gesture was finally accomplished by an actress.
Miss Hermione Baddeley, playing the part of a harassed housewife in The Martin's Nest at the Westminster Theatre, last night heard that leading members of the Housewives League were in the audience. To show her sympathy with their protest against food rationing, she burned her own ration book in front of them after the show.
And Irene Bevan resigned from the cabinet a couple of days later. Ernest Bevin had died just a week before. The end of the post-war Labour government was in sight. Ideal Home, resourceful as ever, suggested one way out of the household crisis in an article by an Essex farmer's wife, Mrs. Ethelyn Fearon.
Keeping a pig can be a profitable hobby. When you have kept it for 6 months, a pig will yield you one good side of bacon, one ham, sundry brawns, sausages and joints of pork, as well as £10 or £12 for the half which you sell to the Ministry of Food, which is more than any hen was ever known to do.
But weren't pigs a bit, you know, smelly?
Pigs are extremely clean and nice in their habits, and will choose one particular corner in which to deposit their droppings. Even if you have no garden whatsoever, not so much as a compost heap or one marrow bed, you can still keep a pig without complaint from the neighbours by removing the manure daily and flushing it down the WC.
Less trouble to keep a man, I think, in the end.
Stafford and Gordon McRae with a message some people still believe. In 1951, it was safer to turn the war of domesticity into a joke, as the Daily Mail humorist Lane Northcott did.
Anxious little reader's piteous cry.
I am about to get married. Unfortunately, I have had no experience of running a home of my own. Can you suggest a suitable timetable that I can work to?
Certainly we can. Try this one. 6 a.m., rise. 6:05, water pot plants, dust dining room, turn on husband's bath. 8 a.m., wake husband with cups of tea.
8:15, prepare and serve breakfast. 8:45, find husband's belongings, brush husband's hat and see him off to work. 8:50, rest and complete toilet.
9, wash up and go shopping for husband's dinner. 10, oil and grease car, check tradesman's accounts, tidy up coal cellar, light bonfire and burn all rubbish.
11:30, sponge and press husband's suits, de-ice refrigerator, take down and beat sitting room curtains, clean bath and polish taps. 12:30, turn out cupboard under stairs, chip garden hedge and weed path. 1 p.m. Eat light, slimming diet.
1:15. Clean kitchen flue with wire brush. Prepare laundry. Distemper scullery. 2. Listen to woman's hour and do bag wash.
2:30. Dig over onion beds, mow lawn, and check all electric fuses. 4:30. Improve mind with some good technical book, such as Mrs. Beaton's Household Management or Home Carpentry for Beginners. 5. Tune piano, stick holiday snaps in album, wash hair, and generally beautify yourself for husband's return.
6. Prepare dinner, change frock, stuff some olives, mix cocktails, lay out husband's slippers. 7. Listen intently for husband's footsteps while keeping dinner hot. Remodel a hat. 7:45 approx, serve dinner.
8:30, wash up dinner things. 9 to 10:30 p.m., entertain husband and darn socks.
Pretty grim sort of joke, wasn't it?
You touch my fingertips and my heart is aglow. You bend to kiss my lips and I can't let you go. Maybe I should resist. I'm a fool, I know. But at a time like this, my resistance is low.
Your resistance is low.
Your eyes have magic. They seem to say, come closer, come closer, my darling, come closer. And somehow I can't break away. Can't you see that I want to be adored more than you'll ever know? And I'm going overboard with the capital O. So don't be persistent. Please keep your distance. You know my resistance is low.
You touch my fingertips
and my heart is aglow.
You bend to kiss my lips
and I can't let you go.
Maybe I should resist. I'm a fool, I know.
Resist me, baby.
But at a time like this, my resistance is low.
I know, I know.
Your eyes,
magic,
they say,
and come closer, my darling, come closer, and somehow I can't break away. Can't you see that I want to be adored more than you'll ever know? And I'm going overboard with the capital O. So don't be persistent. Baby, keep your distance. You know my resistance is low.
Keep your distance. You know my resistance is low.
One of the more curiously atmospheric songs of 1951, My Resistance is Low by Ogie Carmichael, much favoured by housewives in the later months of the year, by which time Elizabeth Taylor had announced,
"Everyone hates me."
The 19-year-old star says she will marry again.
"I am happier married than single,"
she said.
"But next time I want to know the man and like him as well as love him."
And the next time, and the next. More seriously, the king fell ill and complete rest was ordered on June the 5th. Later in the year, he had a lung operation, but was apparently well enough to pose with the family at Christmas.
Two diplomats mysteriously disappeared in June, reportedly sending
"We are well"
telegrams to their mothers from Paris.
But nobody knew where either Mr. Burgess or Mr. McLean really was.
Their families had their theories.
Lieutenant Colonel J.R. Barrett, 65-year-old stepfather of Mr. Guy Burgess, said last night he believes Burgess may be cruising
"Really?"
in a small Mediterranean steamer, unaware of the hunt for him.
For some time, nobody knew any better.
England's first motel was now being built at Kenilworth.
And in August, King Farouk of Egypt lost £50,000 at one go on the baccarat tables at Palm Beach Casino in Cannes. On his way out of the building, he bought a £400 Cartier watch for Queen Nariman.
The average weekly wage in Britain was £6.08, or £332.16 a year.
Britain's Randolph Turpin won the World Middleweight Boxing Championship from Sugar Ray Robinson, to whom he lost it again almost immediately.
And from the South Coast came news of a dramatic rescue.
An older girl was saved from drowning in the sea at Bexhill yesterday by 14-year-old Vanessa Redgrave, a daughter of the actor Michael Redgrave. Vanessa is a pupil at Queensgate School, Kensington.
Well, I bet she was a fan of Ronnie Ranald.
When the sun in the morning peeps over the hill and kisses the roses round my windowsill, then my heart fills with gladness when I hear the thrill of the birds in the treetops on Mockingbird Hill. From the morn with the bee, it gives me a thrill. Awake up in the morning for the mockingbird thrill. From the morn with the bee, that peace and goodwill. You're welcome at the flowers on Mockingbird Hill. Got a three-cornered plow and an acre to till, and a mule that I bought for a $10 bill. There's a tumble-down shack and a rusty old mill, but it's my home sweet home up on Mockingbird Hill. You're the day, you're the awake in the morning to the Mockingbird thrill. You're the day, you're the awake. When it's late in the evening, I climb up the hill and survey all my kingdom while everything's still. Only me and the sky and an old whippoorwill singing songs in the twilight on Mockingbird Hill. Wake up in the morning to the Mockingbird thrill.
Cascade descends from her blue velvet hat to a shoulder of her blue velvet gown. Hands are tucked for warmth into a blue velvet muff. Happy? No bride could look more so. Miss Margaret Roberts, 26, was married yesterday in London to Mr. Dennis Thatcher. She was one of the youngest women Tory candidates in the last election. She was defeated at Dartford.
A blue wedding. From December 1951.
The festival had closed at the end of September. 8 million people had been to the pleasure gardens and 500,000 more than that to the South Bank.
Abide With Me and the National Anthem and Auld Lang Syne were sung, and that was that.
On October 25th, Labour lost the general election, and the new Conservative government lost no time in flattening the South Bank, apart from the festival hall and a few oddments. It stayed flattened for another 10 years. But at least Housewife's Choice had re-established itself in the favour of Franklin Engelmann.
I love the idea of playing a record for Mrs. Dale and Sally and Mrs. Morgan, as Jerry Desmond did on Wednesday of this week.
Mrs. Dale's diary reached its 1,000th edition at the end of November.
The listener's radio drama critic, our friend Philip Hope Wallace, dramatised his attachment to the programme.
So now I suppose the Dales will go on forever,
said the woman on the train.
Yes,
said her companion.
I suppose they will, now.
And with a gleam in the eye which seemed to me less than kind, she added,
but sooner or later, they'll have to get older too.
And all of us in the carriage fell to thinking of Mrs. Dale's deathbed, a senile Mrs. Freeman, and a toothless Gwen. And for a moment we looked, rather frantically, down the vista of the years.
We hope you've enjoyed looking backwards down the same vista.
Yes, that was 1951. Next time, 1952, the Queen's accession, President Eisenhower,
shrimp boats, sugar bush, and Jimmy Young.
So till then, this is Russell Davis.
And Maureen Lipman.
Saying goodbye.
Good luck.
And good heavens, wasn't it all a long time ago?
When Housewives Had the Choice was compiled by Russell Davis and produced by Jonathan James Moore. It'll return to your wireless sets the same time next week.